I wanted to start off by talking about the image or the metaphor of fire that's used in Buddhism. The Buddha, when in his sermons, he talked a lot about fire as a metaphor or as an analogy to life and to the human life, the mind. And there's a famous sutra, scripture, that called the Fire Sermon, this sutta on fire. And it's a very dramatic sutra, and the Buddha kind of goes on and on. And he says, the world is on fire. And the whole world is burning in flames. The world is on fire. The eyes are on fire. The ears are on fire. The nose are on fire. The tongue is on fire. The sense doors, all the sense doors are on fire. And it's burning with the fires of greed, hate, and delusion. And so he used that term. And how to understand that is our question. But he talked a lot about the world is on fire, and it's easy to see. We talk about when people are angry that they're burning with anger, and so anger sometimes is like a flame. But people who have great addictions, great attachments, they're kind of burning with, burning themselves up, exhausting their energy, pursuing what they're addicted to or what they really want. It's very easy to exhaust oneself, exhaust one's energy by too much craving. And look around the world, you read the newspapers, and it's pretty obvious that the world is on fire with greed, hatred, and delusion, parts of it at least. And it doesn't take a lot of looking around to notice how much of the world is in suffering and in pain because of greed, hatred, and delusion. People harming each other, abusing each other, people stealing from each other. All these things going on. Wes Nisker, who's a Vipassana teacher in Berkeley, he was supposed to come to our teacher meeting at Spirit Rock on Wednesday, and he left his house in the morning to get in his car, and his car wasn't there. And the fire of greed, someone took his car. And someone I met with last night, she had both her tires slashed. And I mean, they're just kind of small examples. So the Buddha talked a lot about fire. And then the Buddha talked about nirvana. And nirvana is often described as being the extinction of the fire, the extinguishing of the fire. And a lot of scholars and a lot of people who write about the meaning of the word nirvana say it means the snuffing out of the fire. The fire is a greed, hate, and delusion. Greed, hate, and delusion. However, for most of us, there was a sense in the West that this idea of extinguishing the fire, that nirvana was kind of a great extinguishment, was very threatening to a lot of people in the West, because a lot of people took it to be a kind of nihilism. Because in the West, when a fire is extinguished, the fire of self or whatever, when the fire is extinguished, and what's left of the fire? For most of us, we say the fire is gone, right? It's not there anymore. So the idea that nirvana is extinguishing the flame, is very frightening for some people who are afraid of nihilism, because it means nothing. There's no self anymore, there's no nothing. The extinguishing of consciousness, of awareness, of the world. But I learned recently that in the ancient Indian world that the Buddha was talking in, that when a fire was extinguished, when a fire kind of died out or was snuffed or whatever, the understanding in ancient India was the fire didn't disappear like the way we would, but rather that the fire was released, was given its freedom. And in giving its freedom, it was found everywhere. And the ancient Vedic ancient Indians, pre-Buddha Indians, would talk about fire being found in the stones and in the water and in all the objects of the world. And if fire was extinguished, the fire would hide in those places until it came out again. So the extinction of a fire didn't mean that the fire disappeared. It just went into hiding, maybe you can say in a state of being a potential. So the Buddha adopted this metaphor of the fire from Indian understandings of fire. And he understood it a little bit differently. But what the main point was that nirvana is an unbinding of the fire. The fire is released. The fire of consciousness, of awareness, is somehow released rather than extinguished. And it turns out that this is what when the most famous commentator or teacher in the history of Theravada Buddhism, Buddha Gosha, that's the way he described the etymology of the word nirvana. It meant an unbinding, a releasing. Now, a fire the fuel for fire in Sanskrit and Pali is called upadana, and the fuel of the fire is that which keeps the fire burning, the fires of greed, hate, and delusion, the fire of self, the fire of whatever. But the word upadana also means clinging. It has two meanings. It means the fuel for a fire, and it means clinging. And maybe the reason why it has both meanings is that in Buddhist psychology, they two reinforce each other, the two feed into each other, that when we cling, we're creating further fuel for further clinging, for further attachment, for further becoming, further creating kind of a solid identity, fixed identity, which we obsess with. And in Buddhist psychology, there's a description of how suffering arises in us, for us. Kind of sequential steps in how suffering arises. And this sequence I'm about to tell you is a very important one for Theravada teaching. And a lot of Vipassana teachers will talk about this a lot, because if you understand, not you understand it, but if you can see the sequence in your own experience, you go a long way to understanding how you can release yourself from suffering and from attachment. I'll start with what's called contact. There's contact sensory contact with the world. Based on sensory contact, sensations of the world, experiencing the world, there is a feeling tone to that experience of it being basically pleasant or unpleasant or neutral experience. So I'm sitting here, and right now my knee hurts a little bit. So that's basically kind of a little bit of unpleasant experience. And I could feel my desire to move. And it's okay, you don't have to worry about me. But or early in the day I heard the kind of the fan going. And that was kind of unpleasant. And I kind of wished that the fan would stop because it was kind of unpleasant. So there's an experience, just the sound. And then there's the basic kind of aspect of it, which is in the nature of things, that it's rather unpleasant, pleasant, or neutral. Now, based on whether we experience it as pleasant or unpleasant, there is the possibility of us having a desire in relationship to that, a reaction in relationship to that. So my reaction to the hearing a fan was, I wish it would go away. So I had this desire. Or I wish the pain in my knee would go away. Or I might feel, I went out there and felt the wonderful sun out there. And, could I feel this nice warmth and sunlight all the time? And kind of, as I followed the sun, as the sun moved through the sky, and I would kind of try to stay in the sun and stay warm. There's a reaction. It was very pleasant, and I wanted more of it. And there's nothing particularly wrong with wanting things and desiring things, wanting more warmth or wanting to be quieter or something like that. But that's often the sequence, is that there's some kind of experience that we experience, some kind of sensation, some kind of contact, and that contact has a nature of being pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And based on that, we might create some kind of desire, some kind of wish around it. The next step in the sequence is that there's grasping. It isn't simply, we want the fan to stop, but we grasp at that. We really want that fan to stop, and we're desperate for it to stop, because I was the one who kind of helped set up that we use this room, and if you guys came here very nicely to sit with me, and here's this fan, and here, what a lousy teacher I am, because I got this room that has this noisy all day, and boy, they better turn it off, and maybe if I break down that door, I can find a switch, and you can see I've gotten caught by my, right? So we get caught. And grasping kind of means you get caught. It's a desire that is caught. A caught desire is grasping. And that can be, desire can take the form of aversion also. Aversion or wanting something to be a certain way or wanting something to not be in a certain way. Pushing things away or holding on to things. Based on grasping, so grasping is kind of suffering, it's kind of painful to be caught in that kind of way. You can feel in your body and your mind the tightness, the contraction, contractedness, the closeness to the world around you, because it kind of means you obsess. You're kind of focusing on a narrow part of the world rather than being open to be more open to in a wider sense. Then it says in this sequence in Buddhist psychology that based on grasping, there is usually what's translated into English as becoming, which is maybe like we could say creation. You create something. Something arises. But I think becoming is a word is a good word, because one of the things that we create through our grasping is an identity, for example, and we become something. So you know, I want to be a good meditation teacher, right? I mean, that's like, you know, given. So here, you know, I have a room, set up a room, and the fan is going all day. So how can I be a good meditation teacher with the fan going while I'm teaching? So I'm grasping at trying to be a good, not only trying to get the fan off, but I'm grasping at trying to be a good meditation teacher. And maybe, you know, I manage to turn the fan off or whatever. That habit of thinking helps create, not necessarily a better meditation teacher, but it helps create my identity as a meditation teacher. So the next time I come into this room, I have, you know, stronger identity that way. It's more important. I'm more worried that you're going to, you know, what are you guys going to do with the fan is here next time we come? And so that identity is more intact and comes into more play. So there's a becoming of a being, of an identity. But also there's a becoming of a habit energy. There's a becoming the classic example is if you follow the same path long enough, first you kind of create a footpath there, and then after a while you create a rut, and after a while you create a big gorge and gully and whatever. So, you know, water flows, you know, a little bit, and it kind of goes fine across the hillside, and then it digs a deeper and deeper rut, and pretty soon the water has only one way to travel, is down this gorge it's created. So when we keep creating grasping and attachments and live by it and let it run our life and get caught by it, there's a way in which the grooves of the mind, the ruts of the mind, the gorges of the mind get stronger and stronger, and it becomes almost as if that's the only way the mind can go after a while. And you can see that in people. There are people for whom whose basic operating mode seems to be anger, or whose basic operating mode seems to be generosity, or basic operating mode seems to be some kind of way. And part of that is sometimes has to do with a certain way they've trained themselves by doing things over and over and over again a certain way. And sometimes has to do with more of an expression of an open heart, too sensitive to the world. And something like generosity can be either way. Generosity that arises out of a grasping and a becoming becomes just a kind of rut that you enter into, and you don't see any other possibility, and you start giving people money who's inappropriate. Or it can be just simply sensitivity to the world's needs, and so you respond to it. But I know people who are like cynics, and they've gotten themselves really set on the cynical mode. That's like the deep rut that they follow in their life. Or people who are just deeply conditioned. It's kind of like being conditioned, is a good word. Deeply conditioned to feel the world as a threat, or to feel people are threats, or to feel, you know, to always think people are mistrustful. So there's a world of becoming. Something, there's a consequence of grasping, and grasping regularly in the same way over and over again. And that kind of becoming, because it arises out of what's called grasping, is then a source of increasing grasping, increasing suffering. And if you become something, an identity, then the world threatens that, because any kind of identity is usually a fixed idea of something. And the world, the reality, is not very kind to anything which is fixed, because reality is not fixed. So part of becoming free is not to have these fixed ideas of how things should be, but learning to surf. And that's what you guys were practicing today, was all of us was surfing, rather than fixating. So of course, it's, you know, you're going to go up and down. It's going to be really rough sometime. I mean, that's what the nature of the ocean. You know, sometimes you have big waves, sometimes small waves, and sometimes the, you know, the ocean is completely placid and peaceful, and it's just really nice. And then sometimes it's huge, you know, thunderstorms in the ocean and big waves and crashing. It's just the ocean. That's the nature of the ocean. It's the nature of our mind and our being to kind of go through cycles and up and down. And who knows why? Tendency is for people to think that when their mind is really placid and peaceful and joyful, that then they're really worthwhile people, and then they really got it, and there's something, you know, special. And finally, you know, that's just an idea. That's another kind of becoming, another kind of grasping. And then people think when the waves are really big and you keep falling off a surfboard, well, what a lousy person I am, and I'm unworthy, and this is really bad, and I'm ashamed of myself, and you get angry with yourself, and all the kind of reactions we have. Rather just, you know, learn to surf and fall off and get up again. Don't create any extra becoming about it. It's the nature of life to kind of, you know. Anyway, the point in mindfulness, as you know, is to surf and get back on again and surf some more, not to control the waves. So that's the sequence: contact, feeling, desire, grasping, and then becoming. And the word for grasping is this word upadana, which means both grasping and the fuel for fire, because it's what conditions further becoming. And then from becoming, the whole thing starts over again. It's kind of like a circle in Buddhist psychology. And in the lists that Buddhism is famous for, there are four of these graspings that can cause suffering in our life. And I think that, and this might be nice to share with you what these four are. And I thought that, you know, when I was thinking about this talk, I said, well, you know, a good talk should have lots of examples, so you can relate to the examples. If I just go through the list, you know, what does that mean to any of you? And but I was kind of lazy, and or didn't take the time to figure out, you know, wonderful, great examples. But so what I thought was, rather than me coming up with examples, that I thought it'd be better, you know, if you came up with the examples. And there's a big enough room of people here that I'd be surprised if you can't think of examples. There's only four of them, right? So you should come up with four examples, one for each. And I'll do this. I'll do the four out of sequence, the traditional sequence, partly because I think a lot of Westerners, when they hear this kind of teaching in Buddhism, it seems to be against grasping and attachment. There's all these people, like all these flags go up and say, "What do you mean? I'm supposed to be detached and let go of everything and renounce the world. And what's wrong with a little bit of attachment, or a little bit of desire, and, you know, enjoying life and all that?" And so I thought I'd start with what seems really safe for all of you, so no one would get upset right away, at least. So the first grasping, there's four great graspings that cause suffering, and the first one I'll list is called a translation of this term into English. Could be precepts and practice. Whew, you're all kind of, what a relief. I can let go of grasping at precepts and practice. So I thought that was a safe one to start with. You know, and so usually it's translated as, usually English translation is being attached to rites and rituals, or to commit vows and rituals. Commitments and rituals, but sometimes it's expanded to include precepts in general and practice. And there's many ways in which we can grasp onto practice and precepts. People grasp onto it for security. This is quite a little bit slightly non sequitur, but there's this movie by Woody Allen. What was it called? Was it Crimes and Misdemeanor? Where there's this Jewish family that is sitting around having their Shabbat dinner, and apparently when some Jewish families, there's some, at least, you know, anyway, in this family, there was people like every week a discussion about how much of the Shabbat ritual to do at the dinner. And so the younger, more progressive people was arguing with the old patriarch of the family, you know, if you cut it short, you know, and the father wanted to do it all. And so I guess, as I remember the movie, at some point it became a conversation about the existence and non-existence of God. And so the younger daughter or something said, which would you choose, truth or God, if you had to choose between the two? And the old man said, I would choose God over truth, because without God, there would be no social controls, and we'd all just be wild and live on our just live out our impulses and rob banks and hit each other and do all these things. But because there's God watching us, I'm afraid to do all this. People are afraid. So that was I can't let go of God even in the light of truth, because I can't imagine what the world would be like without that. So a lot of people who cling to precepts, to particular ethical ideals, and sometimes they're called fundamentalists. They exist in almost all religions. So being attached to certain things that are right or wrong, and also being attached to certain practices, and that's a whole range of things, and a whole different reasons to be attached. People are attached to certain practices because they provide security. They provide some kind of relief to the pain and suffering and hecticness in a normal life, and so you want a little bit of calm, and so you're attached to the calm that it gives you, some kind of order perhaps, or get attached to an identity associated to practice. All your friends are Vipassana students. And so you better be a Vipassana student too. And it's important to be not only a Vipassana student, but the best Vipassana student, so your friends will admire you. So that's kind of you're attached to a practice. And or attach to certain rituals. They're thinking that some kind of rite and ritual in and of itself is going to help you become more awake, become more free. There's reasons for rites and rituals, but rites and rituals are never going to lead you to your final freedom. That's possible. They're only kind of vehicles along the way. So now I did you a disservice by giving you examples. So can you think of some examples of how you can get attached, grasp how rites, how there can be grasping to precepts and practices that's relevant in your own life? Have you seen it in yourself? Yeah.
I made a commitment to go to the Monday night sitting as often as possible, and I had stuck to it almost through the entire school quarter. And over the past couple of weeks, finals were coming up, papers were coming up, and I was very busy and very tired. And I found myself getting angry and upset and frustrated because I was torn between going to the Monday night thing and because that'll make me happy, finishing my papers. And several times I finally had to realize that even though the Monday night sittings are very important to me, that it was also very important to be present and finish this assignment and go to bed at a certain time. And somehow it seemed like going to the sitting would actually be counterproductive in terms of waking up.
Beautiful. That's very wise to see that sometimes doing more Buddhist activities is un-Buddhist. or anti-dharmic, or just helps us kind of, doesn't help our life at all. And sometimes some people are better off doing less dharma practice than more, because of just it makes their life more hectic, for example, and they get less sleep and all that. So that's great. Thank you. And also it's nice because you saw something else had more value in that particular time, and you can honor that. And in honoring that, it became easier to let go of the Monday night, right? That's nice. That's the only one we could think of?
One stupid one is I'm like addicted to exercise, and I go to exercise and do aerobics 5 or 6 hours a week. I see now that I'm too old to do that. I'm getting very tired from doing that. So it's really counterproductive. It's tearing me down instead of building me up. but I'm so addicted to the ritual, I'm having a hard time stopping.
Uh-huh.
So that's an example.
Uh-huh. Some practice you keep doing. And probably you're not addicted, it could be that you're not addicted to the ritual, to the practice, but you're addicted to what it represents for you. So there's grasping there. And the interesting, from a Buddhist point of view, what's interesting with something like that is it might be very reasonable and important to have a house and maintain it and pay the bills and all that. And but can you do all that carefully and responsibly and all that without the attachment? See, sometimes we confuse the two. We think that we need to be attached in order to get something done, to accomplish something. And it's possible to be more efficient or just as efficient without the attachment, but being responsible for situations. And then, you know, the classic thing about the word attachment is, because in English the word attachment sometimes has the connotations of being in love with someone. You know, so what's wrong with being attached to someone? Because that kind of means love. Well, if that's what your definition of love, that's fine. You know, it's a matter of definition. But if there, is it possible to love someone without the attachment, is the question. And that's, you know, what we try to investigate and discover. And the offering of Buddhism is, yes, it is possible. Anyway, so that was the first one, practices and precepts. And now, oh yes, you have another one? Because you don't want to get to the second one. No one wants to get to the second one. The second one, see, the second one's where you're all going to get upset.
That's a good one, I thought. It's a little less seen in Buddhism, but it's still there. And see, in common religions, a lot of people think if they practice that their lives are going to be okay. They're not going to experience the tragedies of life. And in the Jewish religion, you have the high holidays, and you pray for a good year. Things are always going to go bad. You're going to get ill, lose your jobs. Just because you practice, very diligent, that doesn't mean
your life's
going to be any better.
Right. So there are people who do certain practices for years and years, thinking that they're protecting themselves from disaster or bad health or whatever, and then they have suddenly their health turns bad, or the stock market crashes, or a comet hits their house or something, and then they get up, then they get angry because they thought they were protecting themselves through certain practices. But I feel, you know, life does get better, but for mindfulness, the criteria is different than what we usually. The criteria is that we've managed to get it back on the surfboard, not that the waves have stopped. Yes.
An example that I'm thinking of being attached to practices and precepts is one that I see at work, where we want programmer and we want to create programs that are robust, that they never break. And so someone gets the idea, we'll write this big document on enumerating this, you know, incredible number of rules about how to do your programming. And that having written that document, we now will never produce another defect in our after a while, that voluminous document actually will get in the way and will prevent people from actually solving their problem directly.
Beautiful. So, you know, maybe a good translation for precepts is rules. Rules and practice, but so, you know, so having a code like that gets in the way. And I'm thinking of this story I heard once about a study of two different styles of teaching ballet. And they taught ballet to these, I guess, they followed these young children as they were taught ballet and as they went through their years. And one group of kids was taught by a teacher who was really particular in the form of ballet. You had to do just this right way and just very, you know, I don't know much about ballet, but had to be very particular and exact about the positions you got into and exactly had to be right and all that. And the other was much more relaxed. You know, just approximately is fine and just get into it and have a good time. And so they followed them through their years. And the ones that were given a little bit more freedom and flexibility, not to have to be so exactly perfect in their form all the time, they're the ones who developed to be more creative ballet dancers. And the ones that were so rule-bound kind of stayed that way, I guess, or something like that. So some big manual is going to prevent people from being creative. Maybe it's better to make mistakes and have to reinvent the wheel sometimes and have your creativity. So any other? And enough, or should we go on to the unpopular one? So the second one, or the, usually what's called the first one, the second one is sensuality. Is one of the things that we grasp at, and a source of tremendous, you know, one of the very powerful things that have to do with grasping and attachments, to sense pleasure, and you know, it's pretty easy to see. How
eating.
What?
Eating.
Eating. Eating is a good one.
Sleeping also.
And sleeping, So you're already starting. So I guess that wasn't so unpopular. It's easier. Easier to recognize that. So what else? What are some sense pleasures that you feel that you get attached to or caught by?
Sex.
Hmm?
Sex.
Sex is a great one.
I feel like I get caught trying to organize my whole day, so it's just this continuation, you know, do yoga, eat the perfect breakfast, get outside to walk before it's too hot,
yes.
Get to the beach when there's not very many people there, then, you know, the sort of, so there's never a gap where things won't be
pleasant,
wonderful and pleasant, and all those things are sensual, if they're just perfect.
And the rest of you don't have that issue. Or it's all been named already. Food, sleep, sex. What else is there?
Coffee.
What?
Coffee.
It should get its own category, right? Sure. And grasping can always be pushing away or holding on. Yeah, definitely. Or just simply being aversive to feeling discomfort of any kind. And so, you know, I don't know, I mean, your situation, is it desire for pleasure or is it aversion from discomfort?
Probably both.
Could be both.
There's, I think, free time, freedom,
mm-hmm.
free time. And this last year, I gave up free time, and it was really for times when it was, these people would say, well, what about your life? And kind of there was a lot of expectation that I should be free to go or do anything I wanted. And I have that in my life. It was a little bit easier for me this last year, but it also would come up, and you know, it would just, I feel the grasping, I just feel myself tightening around this, I think maybe some aversion to the restriction, but also there were desires to go to the beach.
Uh-huh. And not being able to do that.
When I wasn't going to the beach.
Uh-huh.
And, or, you know, just a lot of that. Kind of expectation that there's going to be a lot of pleasures or ability to do what I want to do, or travel.
Well, it's a little bit complicated. It can get complicated because some of what gets oppressed is our own our healthy motivations, and some of what gets oppressed is our identity. So you know, if going to the beach, you know, the reason you need to go to the beach so you can be properly tanned, so you can come back and get a proper girlfriend or boyfriend, and you can't go to the beach because someone asks you, you know, to take them to the hospital or something, and you get angry, you know, that doesn't sound like exactly the, you know, you feel oppressed, yes, but, you know, but if you've had an exhausting week working, and really what you need is to unwind so you can go back to work the next week and not get sick, you know, it seems pretty reasonable, and then to feel oppressed then, it, you know, it feels like it's a little bit different category.
It was amazing how many ways I could find within a more restricted mode. You know, that the attachment to the beach was not, you know, it was the attachment to the beach that had to be that way, or I had to be able to travel. It's amazing to me what I can find within a more restricted mode.
Uh-huh.
When I, you know, when I wasn't grasping.
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, the experience of freedom that you learn from doing a spiritual practice or doing Buddhism is that you don't need anything. you don't need any conditions to be happy. Daydreaming. It can be. Oh, attachment to... sometimes people are attached to the content of the daydreaming, and sometimes to the simple pleasure of it. It's very, very pleasant, and it's very alluring and enchanting to get kind of pulled into the pleasantness of daydreaming. And when you find yourself daydreaming in meditation, one of the things you should be aware of is the pleasure that's found from it. Feel the pleasure and the attachment to the pleasure, rather than just simply noting, thinking, and coming back. Because if you note thinking, and come back, and not the pleasure, you might just slip out that door again. There's nothing wrong with having pleasure. But is it really what you want? Do you want to wake up, or do you want to, you know, drift along in pleasure? And hopefully, at least in meditation time, you want to wake up and find that's more important. And then if you want to have your pleasure from daydreaming, do it some other time. But is that seems different than... It's certainly an attachment that can cause a lot of grief. But is that the same thing as attachment to sensuality, to sense pleasure?
Well, feeling well, maybe.
It could be, yes, it could be. And what occurs to me, you know, is same thing with getting old. If you're used to having a certain amount of energy and a certain kind of wellness, and I mean, aging is not about, you know, aging takes its toll. And if you expect yourself to be like, have the same energy when you were 30 or 20, and are attached to that, and society helps you with that attachment by kind of reinforcing that you're supposed to be that way, then there's a lot more suffering. And I've known people who are embarrassed embarrassed that they're sick, because somehow it's shameful to be sick. Some people, you failed in some important way, you know, if you managed to get sick. And so there's all this attachment and grasping and judgment and around illness. And it's just the nature of life. Sickness, old age, and death visits everyone.
Reading.
Yeah, so, that's a good one.
So what about reading are you attached to?
Well, I find a lot of times if I have a spare moment, I sort of feel I need to get something to read. This is if it isn't just that I there's something in particular that I want to read. It's just that here's this dead time where, and sometimes the time is something like, okay, everyone reads on the toilet, but I read when I'm peeing sometimes. I read while I'm brushing my teeth. I sort of squeeze reading into almost any...
No, you squeeze a little bit of life into your reading. I'm sorry. for interrupting. And, but that's interesting. So is it...
I mean, I've even been... People have said they saw me reading while I was driving.
And you don't remember.
I mentioned they noticed me on the occasional road reading a newspaper while I was driving. Not just parking. Not just at the night.
But what motivates that? Is it the fear of missing something or the uncomfortability of not doing anything? Or is it because it's so much fun to read?
Well, I think it's a kind of fascination with reading. And also there's the kind of... it sort of takes you away when you're in the middle of reading something. And then there's the boredom of sort of day-to-day, you know, just driving a car, brushing your teeth. But, you know, if I'm brushing my teeth and I'm not reading, I tend to sort of hurry through and not get all the teeth. And if I...
So, what is it like for you to come and spend a whole day, like you spent half the day today, but usually come for the whole day, to come on a day like today and not read?
Well, I can manufacture other distractions, but I do find, especially longer retreats, sometimes I feel that impulse to. Especially if there's some print lying around, I sort of feel drawn to. Even here, sometimes I'll find myself. I don't do walking meditation near the bulletin boards, but when I have, look over the posters, brochures, things coming around.
When I was in Burma, you know, I was on an 8-month retreat. And it's all, you know, I didn't talk to anyone really except my meditation teacher for 8 months. And I had this room, and you know, there was no books, no, you know, I was supposed to read, or wasn't, you know, wasn't, I didn't bring anything reading with me because, you know, I was on retreat meditating the whole time. But I had this can of Metamucil with me. And so every day, like every evening, like 6 o'clock, I'd have my Metamucil, and I must have read that can of Metamucil. You know, probably more than anybody else on the planet. It was the only thing to read. Yeah, so I know, you know, reading is a great addiction. And
even when you walk in the street and you drive, you read all the signs. I know I do. Mm-hmm. I find myself reading all the signs, like grasping.
So what's the motivation for that kind of grasping? Is what's?
I don't know. I don't really know, but it's there.
I guess similar things. Sometimes it's reading. A lot of my favorite examples, like just turning on the radio when I'm driving, I notice that there's something unpleasant that'll kind of briefly cross my mind, like, oh, I should have done that, and it's really the aversion to that that drives me to turn on the radio. that's my current hypothesis. You know, that a lot of times there'll be an aversion to something else, and perhaps it would fall in the realm of if a thought is considered to be a sense object, then in that case, I guess that would fall under the category of sensuality based
action,
I guess.
So,
grasping
aversion. So the radio is maybe distracting yourself or soothing yourself.
Right. And I have lots of times when I'll do compulsive things like pick up the newspaper, having just thought of something that I should have done, I wonder if I upset this person. There are all kinds of great compulsions.
And then there's the compulsion, you know, to the attachment, to feel like you always know what's going on in the world, and so you read the newspaper because you have to know, or
that's
have knowledge.
That's rationalization. Say to yourself, oh yes, well I'm getting educated, but it's really
an escape. So it's interesting. We started talking about sensuality, and we got focused on a particular form of sensuality, attachment, reading, and. Maybe we know we're an educated crowd here. The Buddha, had a teaching, taught the abandonment or relinquishment or letting go of attachment to pleasure. And this is very important to stress, that it wasn't because the attachment itself creates suffering. It can lead to disappointment, it can lead to false hope, it can lead to disappointed expectations, and it can reinforce habit energy, as I said. So it's the attachment to sense pleasure which is the problem, not sense pleasure itself. And now I can remember the famous little four verses by Blake about he who binds a joy. I don't know. Do you remember it?
One of the lines is, an unexpressed desire. Now, I don't know if this is from the same, the one that you're thinking of. I know some of the verses.
One of the lines is something like, he who kisses joy as it flies by, lives in eternity's sunrise, or something like that. And anyway, his famous poem by, if you hold on to your happiness, you're in trouble. But if you just simply enjoy it as it goes by, then you're living in eternity's sunrise or whatever. The Buddha, in one of the suttas, he said, the passion for one's desire is a person's sensuality, not the beautiful sensual pleasures found in the world. The passion for one's desires is a person's sensuality. The beauties remain as they are in the world, while the wise, in this regard, subdue their desire, their attachment. So sensuality, that's a problem. The Buddha defines as being the passion for one's desire, the attachment for one's desire. And that's the source of the problem. And there's a wonderful paradox, is that the more, in some ways, the more you can let go of your attachment for sense pleasure, sometimes, often enough, you can feel it more, you can have more. The remember the Inquiring Mind from last Inquiring Mind magazine? There was an interview with Ajahn Amaro, and Wes Nisker, who's the editor of the Inquiring Mind, wanted to have the title being Monks Have More Fun. And so there's two ways of being unbound from sensuality. And one is to realize the true nature, or to understand more deeply the nature of the bait or the sense objects themselves. Maybe, for example, realize they're impermanent. They come and go. And so seeing the impermanence, then not grasping so tightly onto them. But more importantly, is to understand the nature of craving itself, and to see through craving, understand the source, the motivation for the craving. Why do you have this strong craving for sleep, or for reading, or for this or that? What's it providing for you? A great question is, what does this attachment provide for you? Because often it provides something different than the sense pleasure, different than what's obvious on the surface. What does it provide? Does it provide a stronger sense of identity? Does it provide security? What does it provide besides what's, you know, immediately obvious? We're running out of time. And that's, it takes a lot longer to come up with a Dharma talk together. Yes.
I was thinking about something we've been talking about, craving, eating, and craving, sleeping, and stuff. And those are things that our bodies need anyway. And I often find for myself that when I crave them the most, and I'm unhealthily clean, and it's also that I'm legitimately deprived of the adequate amount. And then when I have the adequate amount, then I'm not so crazed.
That's a good point, but I've seen in myself that I can be really tired and I can be cranky, or I can be angry or upset, and I can be really tired and it's fine, no problem. So there could be a legitimate need, and sometimes being right or the combination of being justified and being angry is like, you know, match and gasoline. You know, if you're angry and you're right, you know, about what you're angry about, watch out. You know, you can go to town then. So in that situation, it's a little bit dangerous, because you need to take care of yourself, and there might be legitimate reasons why you need to go to sleep and get some rest or food or whatever. But you use that rationalization then to get angry or upset or all these other things that we do. And sometimes, you know, it's easy to go get a nap or get some sleep, but there are times when we can't do that. And that's really when our practice is tested, is when the world prevents us because it's from getting the sleep that we think we need, and there's no chance of getting it. Can we find our equanimity and our peace with that also? So, since we run out of time, I'll just tell you the other two. And since you've caught on slowly on how to do this on your own, you can finish the talk on your own later. In your own privacy. You know, no one has to embarrass themselves. The third is to views and opinions. And the fourth is to the concept of a self. And I'm thinking of giving a talk on self and no self again on Monday at Palo Alto. And I do that periodically. It's one of the favorite topics at Theravada Buddhists. And hopefully I won't bore you by doing it again. I'll do it in a new way. Because I always want to try to find some way to kind of make, because I feel no one understands it. But I want to try to hopefully get, you know, or if you understand it maybe intellectually, but really understand it in your gut. Is the trick. So I'm always trying to find other ways of talking about self and no self. So that's what I'm thinking of. The other thing I was thinking of talking about Monday was, I was so impressed last Monday, with those of you who were there, who weren't there, I asked how many people Monday night felt oppressed by time. And a lot of hands went up. And I said, well, maybe we should ask it the other way. How many people are not oppressed by time? And three hands tentatively went up. One person kind of put their hand up and she looked around. And I was really impressed by that. And I thought, talking about time a little bit and the attachments and the oppression of time is really sounds like it's really important for our community. So those are the two things I thought of, time and self and no self. And if you have a preference to which one you want to hear Monday, you can let me know. But right now I'm leaning towards self and no self. And so let's sit just for a minute or two.